It's all fun and games until someone loses an eye. In this episode, I want to talk a bit more off the cuff than usual about some of the dangers of actualize.org and just the general dangers of doing this work that we're doing. I'm talking about the dangers of taking personal development to the existential level, to the metaphysical level, to the spiritual level. So many of you are following along, you're listening to me talking about enlightenment awakening, you're listening to me talk about the Buddha or meditation or yoga, some of this sort of stuff. And I get the sense that you're not really aware of what you're getting yourself into. And so it can be good to talk about this, and that's what we're going to cover today. So what are the dangers of actualize.org? Sometimes I get criticized for my teachings being dangerous. That's right. But you have to understand that the very nature of these teachings is, like, what are we really doing here with these teachings? We're not merely talking about how to make money or how to attract a partner or how to improve some aspect of your life, like your health and so forth. This is ordinary sort of boilerplate self-improvement. Of course, I've covered those topics a lot in the past, and this is kind of a sort of a self-improvement which isn't very threatening to people. You know, this is sort of a Tony Robbins style self-improvement, and it's great. You know, I started off, I cut my teeth on Tony Robbins, nothing against him. It's useful. It's very useful. But there's a deeper level. There's the existential level that we're talking about. And then you get into spirituality, and you start to learn about non-duality and awakening and enlightenment and all this. And that's when it gets a little bit more tricky, because there, the teachings actually do have certain dangers. I've talked about this to some extent in the past. I have an episode about ego backlash. Go check that out. Understanding Ego Backlash, I believe it's titled. And I have another episode called The Dark Side of Meditation, where I also cover some of this stuff. But there's more that needs to be said. So on this path, if you're pursuing awakening, you have to understand that awakening is not for most people. You have to really question why you're pursuing awakening. And the more I pursue awakening myself, the more I study it as well, the more I interact with other people and read their stories of how they've awoken or failed to awaken, and the problems that have come from that, and the ordeals and difficulties and obstacles that they encountered, one of the things that I realized is that awakening is extremely unique. The spiritual path is totally unique to you, because it has to deal with your own fears, limiting beliefs, neuroses, traumas that you suffer through. And I think even beyond that, of course, it also has to deal with your own, it has to take into account your own personality, has to take into account even your genetics and your physiology, has to take all of that into account, right? Like, for example, the spiritual process might be different for an introvert than for an extrovert. That doesn't mean that an extrovert can't become awakened. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's different. Different techniques might resonate with different types of personalities, but it goes even deeper than that. Ultimately, what needs to happen is you need to be able to fully surrender yourself when we're talking about the deepest levels of awakening, and then you need to be able to embody that and to really let go of all of your personal shit, whatever that is, all that personal shit that you've accumulated throughout your entire history in this lifetime. A lot of it goes back to your childhood traumas and how you were raised, you know, what kind of ideologies were fed into your mind. Was it Christianity? Was it Islam? Was it some materialistic atheism? Was it skepticism? Was it cynicism? You know, all that stuff. Now you're having to question all those ideologies. That's going to be different for everybody, depending on where you were born, what time you were born, what culture you were born in, what kind of parents you had. Did they abuse you? How did they punish you? How did they reward you? Did they withhold love from you? Did you get enough love when you were a child or not? And did you get bullied in school and all of this, right? So all of this makes this journey very personal, first of all. But second of all, there's an even deeper layer. And that is the one that I think, honestly, I think most people that are alive right now are not ready for awakening. Their psyche, or we might even say their soul, is not ready to surrender materialistic existence. That's most people on this planet. There seems to be, and I'm sort of speculating here, but there seems to be a sort of a logic to how living beings evolve through life. By which I mean that literally there's a sort of a series of incarnations that consciousness goes through, from lower life forms to higher life forms and then beyond. And it really seems to me that most human beings who are alive right now, it's not the case that all human beings are on the same level and that they're all equally capable of awakening and that they're all equally developed and that they're all equally willing to discover the truth or to even care about the truth. No, it just, that doesn't explain it. The majority of mankind are in such a low state of consciousness that even if you show them the truth, even if you show them God, even if you show them some of the stuff that I've talked about, they won't be able to handle it because it's not right for them yet. It's not their time yet. Maybe they need to live through 10 more lifetimes before they finally realize they become conscious enough to see that really the highest way to live life is not materially. And I'm saying this not as somebody who's completely above material existence, but actually the opposite. I'm saying it because I still feel within myself various materialistic attachments that I have, sometimes to money, sometimes to sex, sometimes to whatever. Right? And I see that I have a very clear vision of like what it would mean to be fully awake and to be able to embody that, to live from God consciousness all the time. But it's a beautiful, incredible vision of what I could become, and of course what anybody could become. There's nothing special about me in this regard. But then in trying to actualize that, I also see all of the Buddhists call them defilements that I have, and all of the spiritual purification work that needs to happen. A lot of disciplining of myself and purifying myself in various ways, purifying my mind, purifying my body and all this, purifying my diet, purifying the news sources that I watch, the way I entertain myself, you know, what do I do for entertainment and relaxation, like all of this stuff. And so really, they have some good models and theories about this in Buddhism and also in the yogic systems. You know, like, for example, in the yogic systems, they talk about, if you consider seven chakras, you've got your base chakras, which is, you know, starting from the very bottom of your spine going upwards. You know, your first chakra, chakra one, corresponds to your most basic needs, like your needs to defecate and your needs to just be physically safe and just like very earthy type of needs, you know, basic survival needs without which you couldn't even be an organism. And then, you know, you move up to second chakra would be your sort of genital area. It's responsible for that, of course, controlling your sex drive. So if you're, for example, a person who's addicted to sex all the time and you can't get sex out of your mind and it's just this constant thing that's always like your whole life is dominated by sex and the need for sex and the pursuit of sex, and you invest thousands of hours into this, you know, planning how to get more sex and, you know, all this sort of stuff. If that's what your life is about, then you're kind of like living at that chakra two level. And that's kind of like where you are in this lifetime. And then you can evolve beyond that to chakra three, which is more of your navel area. And then, you know, that corresponds to certain things as well. And then so you kind of move up, then you move on to the heart chakra, the throat chakra, and then, you know, the third eye, and then ultimately the crown, which corresponds to ultimate liberation and, I guess you could say, total Buddha nature, total God realization. So that's an interesting model. It's pretty useful as far as talking about this. See, so a lot of people are stuck. People who get into self-help, they're stuck at those, let's say, those first three chakras. So teachings which are talking about the higher chakras they fall on deaf ears. It's like in one ear and out the other. Or even if they resonate with you to some degree, you're so stuck on your lower chakras that you can't really actualize the higher ones. Maybe you can, you know, take a psychedelic and it'll show you a peak experience of a chakra 6 or chakra 7, you know, some visionary mystical state or full non-dual God consciousness. You get that on a powerful psychedelic. That's great, but then you fall right back down into chakra 2 and you're addicted to sex and you're addicted to junk food and you're addicted to porn and you're addicted to TV and whatever else, YouTube these days. I guess it is with you guys. But hey, you know, I'm guilty of that too. I don't actually have a TV, but I still watch quite a bit of YouTube. So anyways, the point of all this is that, you know, some of you, I get the sense that when you hear me talking about awakening so much, then you get interested in awakening simply because I'm talking about it. And then it's like, you get this sense that, well, the point of my life is to awaken. Everybody needs to awaken. And that's not quite right. That's a mistake. First of all, there's zero normativity behind awakening. So never have I said, nor will I ever say, that you must awaken and that awakening is the one right path for everybody and that there's a good reason for you to awaken. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever for you to awaken. Other than that, you want to. You want to discover the truth. You care to experience God, or you care to understand reality. If these things are interesting to you, then pursue awakening. If you're tired of material existence and you feel dissatisfied with it and you're looking for some way out of the rat maze, pursue awakening. But if you just entered the rat maze, if you just started your material existence and you're still not fed up with it, and maybe you're not really interested in truth, like if you're honest, like, do I care about the truth? No. I mean, Leo talks about it, but I don't care about it. I would just care about, like, having a nice career and having a nice family and having a nice spouse and, you know, hanging out with the family and just doing fun stuff and whatever. Like, if that's honestly what you are driven towards, pursue that rather than lofty metaphysical topics that I talk about. See, I talk about these topics because I'm passionate about them, because I care about them, because to me, really, my highest drive in life is just understanding for its own sake. I don't really care about success. I don't really care about money. I mean, I do to some extent, but all of this is secondary. I don't really even care about living, per se. I don't care about doing social stuff. I don't care about having a family. I don't care about socializing with people, small talking with people, you know, going to parties, having cars and doing this and going on fancy vacations around the world. I mean, of course, I can enjoy these things. And sometimes I do get a little bit sidetracked by one or two of those things. You know, I'm still interested in sex and so forth. But generally, what I care about is understanding for its own sake in the abstract. Right. So that's my bias. You might not have that bias. And the reason I might have that bias, like, you don't know, like, you don't know, like, if we take the sort of past lives model seriously, and I'm not saying that it's literally the case, but, you know, it's an interesting theory, sort of like you have past lives, and then you live through these lives, and in each life, you experience enough of it that some wisdom, some kernel of wisdom is developed, and that kernel actually survives your life until, you know, then you incarnate into the next life form. And then from that one, you're still tapped into some of that old residual wisdom that's left. It's not like in some verbal form. It's not like you retain some teaching that I told you through this video in your next life. That's not what I mean. I mean that overall, once you've lived your entire life, you've sort of, what happens is, what I notice is that you exhaust certain motivations and needs. Have you noticed this in your own life, for example? That, like, when you were younger, maybe when you were a teen, or when you were in your 20s, there was something that you were super passionate about that was so important to you, whatever it was. Might have been family, might have been relationships, might have been religion, might have been science, might have been skepticism, might have been rationality, might have been success, might have been money, might have been health, might have been working out, whatever. But then you do that thing for 5 or 10 years, and then you kind of just, like, get over it. And then one day it's almost like, It's almost like you've become a new person or a new being in the sense that you've transcended that, like you've gotten it out of your system. And you don't feel motivated by that thing anymore. Like you, at a certain point, you've earned enough money where it's like, okay, I've done that. I've done enough business to the point where starting a new business doesn't excite me anymore. It would just be the same old thing. I need something new to satisfy my soul. Yeah? Maybe you've experienced this in some capacity. I think all of us do. I think for some people, it can take them an entire lifetime or it can take them decades to get something out of their system. In some cases, you might be so stuck on a thing that you never get it out of your system in this one lifetime. Like maybe you're so stuck on sex that that's all you're concerned about and your whole life will be devoted to that, to the pursuit of it. And you're never going to get it out of your system, no matter how much sex you have in this lifetime. But from that process, what I'm hypothesizing here is that you could learn some sort of deeper meta lesson, a lesson that goes beyond just this one lifetime, which will stick with you, with your spirit, let's say, if you want to say, call it that, such that in your next incarnation, you're not going to be so driven by the sex. You're going to just quickly get over it. It's not like you're not, you'll still have some sex, but it's like your life's not going to be about that. It's going to be a little side dish, you know, a little garnish on the side. Whereas your main thing in the next lifetime will be something more, something deeper, something higher, something more consciousness. And then maybe from that position, you can then pursue awakening more seriously. So I want you to just to double check yourself. Are you pursuing awakening because maybe you're just like a monkey? Monkey see, monkey do. And you hear me talking about it so much that you've just internalized this as some goal that you need to have, when in fact you don't need to have it. Here you have to be very honest with yourself. This can be painful to admit, because maybe you've already invested a few years into meditating and yoga and all this stuff, and you've been pursuing awakening. But now I'm telling you, like, wait a minute, maybe that's not the thing you should be doing. And now, of course, that's kind of throwing a wrench into your works, and this could feel threatening to you, because, you know, you don't want to be robbed. You feel like you've already been on this path and now you want to go, but it feels like now I'm taking that motivation away from you, making you doubt yourself. Well, that's part of this work. A huge part of this work in life is figuring out what you want from life. What are you really motivated to do? Sometimes, a lot of times, actually, because of the media we watch or because of the ideas we hear from our teachers, professors, our parents, our rabbis and our religious leaders and so forth, we get certain ideals into our minds. Like, well, I should be a good person. I should be like Christ. I should be like a Buddha. I should become a monk. I should follow what Leo says. I should awaken and I should do all this stuff. When really, if you were honest, you would admit that I just want sex. I just want money. I just want pleasure. I just want a big house with a fast car. And I want to go fly around the world and party and do this sort of stuff. See, that can be hard to admit. In this sense, ideals can be dangerous because they can be inauthentic. Often our ideals, where do we get them from? We just absorb them from our culture. And then we think that they're our own goals and desires and motivations, but actually they're not. And it can be difficult to admit to ourselves that, wait a minute, this ideal that I've been chasing, it's just been sort of a fantasy that I picked up because, you know, I went to 10 years of Sunday school and, you know, they drilled it into my mind that I need to be Christ-like and that sex is wrong. See, but that's an inauthentic conditioning that you've been programmed with. See? And you can spend your whole life kind of stuck at, like, trying to be Christ-like. But it's like, really, you're shooting above your above your pay grade, I guess you might say. We're mixing metaphors now. But you're punching out of your weight class, you see? Because if your level of development and consciousness and maturity is like down here, but you're trying to act all Christ-like, it's actually going to create huge problems because you're going to, in your mind, you're going to have this idea of trying to be Christ-like, but you're always going to fail to live up to the idea. That's going to create a lot of suffering for you. And you're not going to be confused because you don't know, like, well, what's wrong with me? Something, I'm defective, I'm broken, I'm wrong, you know, why can't I be Christ-like? And then maybe you look to some monks who have done it and you say, well, why can't I do what they are able to do. And the reason might be that, you know, they spent 30 lifetimes pursuing that, whereas you are just like, you've been pursuing it for 2 lifetimes. But you're just not conscious of that right now. And so it's actually totally normal that you're struggling through this stuff, because you don't know what those monks suffered through and struggled through, you know, what the Buddha went through, what Christ went through, how many lifetimes did Christ live through? Like, you don't know this stuff if we're going to take this kind of past lives model seriously. You don't know. Or if you don't like the past lives model and you want to, you know, instead think of it in terms of genetics, you can think of it in terms of genetics. It really doesn't matter, like, the details of it. Like, you can just make this all very scientific if you like. And you can just say, well, some people are genetically inclined and predisposed to, you know, to have a sort of personality type that makes them interested in truth and metaphysical topics and spirituality, and other people are not. You could couch it that way. It doesn't really matter. What matters is for you to kind of discover authentically what it is that you want, and then to pursue that. Because otherwise, what'll happen is, and here's where we kind of get to the original topic. We kind of went on a tangent, now we're coming back, of the dangers of this work. If you're serious about awakening, what you're talking about here, understand, this is the most radical and hardcore thing you can do. Okay? So if my teachings seem dangerous, yeah, because we're talking about life and death issues here. We're talking about the software that is running your entire life, and not just that, but beyond that, we're literally talking about the software that creates a sense of physical reality for you. So when we're talking about awakening, we're talking about becoming conscious of all of that and transcending all of that. See, this is very threatening for most people. This might mean the loss of friendships and family connections. This might mean you have to abandon your family. This might mean you have to abandon your business. This might mean you have to abandon your house. This might mean you have to abandon your country. This might mean you have to abandon your religion. This might mean you have to give up your national identity. And this is still just the tip of the iceberg of what might be required here. In the end, you're going to have to give up your whole life, basically, for this. And if you're thinking, well, Leo, then why would I do it? Why would anybody do it? Well, then you're not ready. You see, if you're asking that question, you're not ready. You don't have enough innate wisdom and consciousness to realize why somebody would want to pursue the truth despite all of those costs. See? If you were really at a certain level of development and spiritual purity, you would want the truth no matter what. See, you wouldn't be held back by these things. You wouldn't be so interested in these things. You wouldn't be so attached to these things. You would want to know what the truth is. You'd want to know what God is. You'd want to know what life is. You'd want to know what reality is, just for its own sake. And if you're not there, then you're not there. And it would be good to admit it rather than to fake it. Because if you're going to fake it, the problem is that, look, sometimes this path will get dark. It can get very dark. If you're meditating a lot, stuff will come up. Issues will come up. You'll have phases where you're depressed. You might have phases when you're suicidal. You might feel like life has lost all meaning. You might doubt yourself. You might doubt whether this was the right path to go down. You might have mystical experiences, or you might take psychedelics, and you might misinterpret what is shown to you because you still have so much ego and you're still working from the lower chakras, let's say. And so maybe God is revealed to you, but because you have so much ego and you're working from the lower chakras, you will corrupt and misunderstand or misinterpret. Remember, because you're always sort of filtering any psychedelic experience or any mystical experience you're having. You're always interpreting it. The mind is still there and it's still interpreting through your past experiences, your personality, you know, through the filter of who you are as a human. You're interpreting all that, and then corruption can happen. There have been cases, and in fact, I have some books on my book list. In one particular book, the reason I put on my book list in the spirituality subcategory is because this entire book just explains the sort of gut-wrenching experience of one woman who accidentally basically awoke without even knowing what awakening is. In her youth, she did some, when she was like in her early 20s and in her college days, she did some yoga practice and she did some meditation and so forth. But when she was doing it, nobody really explained to her what awakening is, what non-duality is. She didn't know any of that. She didn't really understand what God is or anything. She didn't have the enough theoretical foundation, you know, the kind of stuff that we've built here with actualize.org, if you've been watching for a while. She had none of that. She was just taught some meditation techniques. And she basically did that. And then one day, even after, you know, she stopped doing them, but then one day just something clicked in her while she was walking down the street and she awoke. But this completely terrified her and she thought that something had gone terribly wrong. She thought that she was broken and dysfunctional. She thought she had some sort of mental illness. She spent the next 10 years going to therapists and doctors trying to fix herself. Because, you know, she would go to a therapist or a doctor and she would tell the doctor, like, I don't have a sense of self. There's no me. It's like I wasn't even born. And the doctor would look at her like she's crazy. Now, of course, she was totally right. The problem is, though, she didn't have the right context. She didn't have enough theoretical foundation and she didn't have the kind of environment that could support her in that, because all the people she hung around with, including her doctors and therapists, they were all clueless about non-duality and awakening. And so, you know, it's probably a little easier now because you can go online and just Google it. This was probably before the age of the internet where you could Google this stuff easily. But eventually what happened was that it took her many years and it was gut-wrenching. You know, she couldn't sleep. She had bad nightmares. She was stressed. She was anxious. She was like, she couldn't lead a normal life for many years. And it almost drove her nuts until eventually, by accident, she found some people, you know, some meditators and some folks who knew about non-duality who actually helped her out and gave her some guidance and helped her to recontextualize that sense of no self and to make more sense of it and to realize that there's even deeper. You can even go deeper into that awakening and to realize not only is it no self, but it is the self, the God self. She wasn't understanding that there's the God self in addition to the no self. Really, it's just another additional facet, but she was missing that facet. She was missing other important facets like the facet of love and so forth. So the reason I'm telling you this story is just because so this kind of stuff can happen. That's one example of the dangers here. Other dangers might include that you get depressed and suicidal, and then you actually act that out. And, you know, I've had some dark phases in my journey. And it's difficult. Sometimes you're all alone and you got nobody to talk to, nobody who can understand what you're going through, nobody who can help you. That's all part of this path. See, like I said at the beginning, this is a hardcore path. This is a kind of path that you have to be sort of a you have to be able to lead yourself. You have to be able to figure stuff out. You have to be able to troubleshoot your own problems. You have to be able to think independently. You can't, ultimately, when you're trying to totally awaken, you can't rely on anybody to help you. Not even your guru can help you. You're going to be totally alone at the very end of it. Now, don't worry. Once you get past all the humps and so forth, it'll be great. It's wonderful. So I'm not trying to discourage you by telling you that awakening is all negative and bad. It's not. The problem is that your ego is in the way. You see, you have defilements. You're operating from lower chakras. You're not spiritually purified. And who knows how much of that work you've got to do. That's a gut-wrenching process, this spiritual purification business. And a lot of it gets kind of not advertised by spiritual teachers. They make it seem like, oh, you just sit down, you just meditate for a few weekends, or you do a few retreats, and then bam, enlightened. That's not really how it works. Even when the so-called spontaneous, instant, total awakening happens, who do you want to cite? Eckhart Tolle or Ramana Maharshi or something like this? You want to say, oh, Leo, is spontaneous instant awakening. No work, no effort, no thousands of hours of meditation, nothing. Just bam, it happened. No, this is a pipe dream. It didn't just happen. Eckhart Tolle was at the brink of suicide. He was going to kill himself. By some fluke luck, he awoke rather than killing himself. See, so that's hardcore. That's serious. Think about how many people in our society, rather than awakening, they do kill themselves. More than those who awaken. I'll tell you that much. See, so that's not a very good path to take. Now, I'm not saying this to say that it has to be this way for you. I'm just saying that, you know, there's a whole range, a vast, giant range of possibilities, because you're going to have to conquer your own ego. And what does that entail for you? For everybody, it's different. You know, for some people, their ego is addicted to alcohol, and that's their biggest demon. And they're going to spend the next 20 years conquering that, struggling with it. And then, you know, for others like me, for me, alcohol has absolutely zero appeal. Zero appeal. Like, I don't care about alcohol. I'm not attracted to it whatsoever. So for me, it's so easy to stay away from it. But for some people, it's very difficult. Or with sex, or with money, or with whatever. You know, so what is that for you? The problem is not actually having an awakening experience per se. That's almost the easy part, although still hard for most people. The problem is actually accepting the truth, accepting it, and then not just intellectually accepting it, although of course that is still a problem for most people. You know, most people, for example, they don't want to admit just something as simple as the fact that your birth was imaginary, or that science is imaginary, or that reality is imaginary. You know, most people don't even want to admit this on an intellectual level. But even if you do, it's not enough to just admit that intellectually. Then you have to go to the next level, and you have to say, okay, well, now how do I need to change the way that I live? How do I need to change my habits, my thoughts, and my emotions to align with that truth? You see, because right now your habits, actions, and emotions and your whole life is aligned with the opposite truth. It's aligned with the truth that reality is real, not imaginary. And so that's challenging. See, you got to be able to kind of guide yourself through this process. Now, of course, you can rely on other people. There are great teachers out there, and you know, you can rely on certain things that I say to help to guide you, but not too much. You can't totally rely on the things that I say or other teachers say, because in the end, you got to sort of figure this puzzle out for yourself. That's the magic of life, is that nobody can really solve your puzzle for you. We all have our unique maze that we're running through, like I talked about in my Life is a Maze episode. So you're going to have to solve your own maze. You can't look at what I'm doing and then cheat the way, you know, you used to do in first grade or something. You would cheat at your friend's test, you know, look at the answers and just copy them. That doesn't work, because we're not all working on the same test questions. It's not so simple. So, yeah, if you're going to go all the way, be prepared for all sorts of stuff that comes up. Inner demons, definitely depression. There will be moments of that for sure. For sure. Because you're going to have to come face to face with meaninglessness if you're going to awaken. You can't avoid that. Because meaning is what your ego projects in order to survive and to do its ego stuff. Meaning is imaginary. And at some point in your awakening process, you're going to have to accept that all meaning is imaginary and created. Now, to the ego, that's going to feel very negative and bad. It's not actually negative. It's not actually bad. It just feels that way, and it's interpreted that way by the ego. There are a lot of pathologies in the awakening process, and I'll have an entire separate episode in the future where I talk about the pathologies of awakening. There are pathologies pre-awakening, and there are pathologies post-awakening. This is ways in which, see, it's almost like the ego is one of those horror film creatures where you got to kill it all the way to kill it. Because if you just kill it halfway, it's still half alive, and, you know, it'll come in and it'll grab you and it'll get you. So that's the thing, is, you know, you have these awakenings, but then usually there's a closing down and there's a sort of a returning and a regression back to the lower chakras. It's usually hard for people to just kind of like go all the way up to the top chakra and just stay there forever and never regress down. Usually it's a sort of an oscillating process of up and down and up and down and up and down. It's going to be very trying. It can be painful. It can be uncomfortable. For example, you can, not only is this happening at the psychological level, physically things can happen to you. You could have, for example, Kundalini awakenings, energetic awakenings in your spine, in your body, where like you can't sleep. You're having nightmares. You're restless all the time. You have too much energy, or you have too little energy, or, you know, the opposite. You're too sleepy. You're sleepy all the time. You might have some psychosomatic issues that come up for you. You might have nervousness and panic attacks. I know on the forum, one fellow on the forum took some 5-MeO-DMT and you know, had a pretty big revelation of God consciousness. But it seems like he wasn't really ready for it, so it scared the shit out of him. And then, you know, like for the next month, he had difficulty sleeping because, you know, he would just have anxiety going to sleep because of the sort of the nothingness. I don't know exactly what he was afraid of, but, you know, something along the lines of like afraid of the void or afraid of losing your mind. That's another one that comes up. And, you know, some of these fears and concerns and dangers, they're legit. So what I'm saying here in this episode is, it's not just all illusion. You do have to take some of these dangers seriously, and you have to be able to figure out what you can tolerate and what you can't. Sometimes, for example, we get it in our minds, you know, we read some book about some advanced meditator who went off into the Himalayan caves and sat there for 6 months straight and barely ate anything and starved himself half to death and, you know, became awakened by meditating 20 hours a day for 6 months straight. And it sounds so cool, and it sounds so macho, and it sounds so like, oh, wow, that's the ultimate ideal. And then, like, I'm going to try to go do that. And then you go do that, and you can't do it. That's right. You know, doing something like that, very, very few people can do something like that to actually pull that off. They have to be, it's not just a matter of certain physical conditioning or certain mental conditioning. It's like they have to be at the right place in their life. They have to be, they have to have a certain proper set of motivations. They have to be a certain level of development and maturity to pull something like that off. So you just aping them, it's probably not going to work. You have to figure out what your path is going to be and what's going to work for you, because, you know, you might try to go do that and you might actually kill yourself sitting there in some Himalayan cave in the ice cold in the middle of winter. And then, you know, a blizzard comes and then you freeze to death. And then we hear about you in the news, you know, frozen like an ice cube sitting in a cave trying to be a Buddha. You know, yeah, that is a danger. Or, you know, if you're getting involved with psychedelics, of course, there's a whole set of dangers that come with psychedelics. And I've been honest about the dangers of psychedelics from the very beginning, since I started talking about them. Of course, they're there. You have to be extremely careful about psychedelics. The way that I see most of you doing psychedelics, I think, is completely reckless and dangerous and irresponsible, gives a terrible name to psychedelics, and is going to harm you and actually retard your path. The way many of you do psychedelics is not how I do psychedelics. I'm very, very careful about psychedelics, precisely because I appreciate the dangers. So we're having this conversation because I just want to make you aware of these dangers so that you're more cautious and you try to figure out what you can tolerate here. And, you know, if you're finding yourself where you're on this path, you're meditating your ass off and so forth, and you're just like, you're in a deep depression, some deep dark night of the soul type of deal. And, you know, what do you do in this case? Well, some people would say, fuck it, just push through it. And everything will be great in the end. Well, you have to be careful. That might have worked for them, given where they are at, you know, what their past lives were, if you want to say that, what their genetics are, and a ton of other things, what their physical health is like. You know, all of these factors play into it. You might not be able to do that. So you have to be willing to let go and take a step back. You know, there's one of my favorite Bond movies. I've watched all the Bond movies. I'm a pretty big fan, especially the old ones. You know, the new ones I'm not so interested in anymore. It seems like they've kind of degraded. But some of the really old classic ones, the Sean Connery ones and so forth, I loved to watch those when I was younger. And there was one that they used to run on HBO like all the time. Never Say Never Again. It was actually one of the last Sean Connery Bond movies. He came back to do it. I think it's one of the best ones. And the villain in that movie is great. I don't know who the actor's name is, but there's this one scene in that Bond movie, somewhere towards like the first third of the movie, where, of course, this was all set like in the 70s or, yes, probably in the 70s or 80s. And so Bond is facing off against this Bond villain. And this Bond villain, this, you know, this was the time of arcade machines and video games were just coming online. So this Bond movie actually featured some, like an arcade, and there was just like classy like hotel, you know, in Europe somewhere, where this Bond villain, you know, he made his own like arcade game, and it was this game of world domination. And so he challenges James Bond to sit down to play this game of world domination with him. And it's this kind of interesting, it's almost like a ping pong table, but it's got this like digital screen instead of a net, and they're both sitting on two ends of this ping pong table sort of arcade machine, and they have these two controls. It's almost like airplane joysticks, but they have two of them each. You know, the Bond villain over here holding him and the Bond character over here holding him. And now, you know, they're playing this game and we're looking at it from, you know, from the audience's perspective. And so, but there's a twist because, you know, of course he's a Bond villain. So it just can't be this simple. It can't just be a video game. So what he did to make this, you know, the stakes high in this game is that there's an electrical shock that comes through the joystick handles. And the way the game works is that if you're holding the handles and you're playing this game, but, you know, as you do worse in the game, the shock gets worse and worse and worse to the point where it'll kill you if you lose the game. You know, it can happen to both sides depending on how good you play. But you always have the option to let go of the controls. And if you let go of the controls, you basically lose the game. You forfeit the game, but you save your life. So now the stakes are high. Now it's interesting, right? So now Bond is sitting there playing and the villain is sitting there playing, they're both playing it, and, you know, the villain is scoring points on Bond, and, you know, it's shocking him, and you can tell, like, oh, this is hard to take, you know, this is getting to dangerous levels. And then, you know, Bond starts to win the game, and then, you know, now the villain is getting the shock, and, you know, he understands how this whole thing works. And there's this brilliant moment at the very end of this scene, which I always found had, like, a deep wisdom to it, which is that the Bond villain is getting to the point where, you know, he's going to lose. Because James Bond has figured out how to beat him in this game, at his own game. And, like, it's getting to the point where, like, everybody's watching and they think he's, you know, the Bond villain is going to get electrocuted to death. And at the very, very end, he just lets go. He just lets go. And you can tell that, like, right there, if he held 1 second longer, it would have killed him. But, you know, the Bond villain, he was smart, right? That's what wisdom is. In life, you gotta understand your own self so well that you know when to let go. Sometimes you just gotta let go. And what I mean here specifically is, like, you might be shooting for awakening and you might be doing some meditation retreat, and now you might be in such deep depression and misery, and you gotta know, like, okay, now I'm at the point where I just gotta let it go. Stop this. Let me just go back to my old life. Let me stop the meditation for a while. Let me take 6 months off or a month off or whatever. Let me quit this retreat because I'm just not ready. I thought I was ready. I put in my best effort, but I'm not ready. See? And rather than taking it to some dangerous level where I actually hurt myself physically or psychologically or traumatize myself, I'll just let it go. knowing that I can come back to it. You know, there's no immediate need for you to get awakened right now. You can do it in a week. You can do it in a month. You can do it in a year. You know, you've got quite a long life to live. And what you might discover from one of these retreats is you might discover that there's more basic stuff you got to handle before you're ready to fully surrender your material existence. See? And that's okay. Sometimes people email me or send me private messages through my forum, and that, you know, they share some dark moment that they're going through. They feel all alone, or they feel depressed, or they feel like life is meaningless, or they're having some Kundalini symptom. You know, they can't sleep, they're having anxiety, whatever. What's the solution to this stuff? Well, there's no way I can give you a concrete answer. It all depends on your specific situation. And really, the solution is for you to better know your own self, not to ask me or some guru, but to dig inside of your own self and to be honest with yourself about where are you at? What can you tolerate? Is this healthy? Is it unhealthy? There are healthy ways of pursuing awakening and doing meditation, and there are unhealthy ways of doing it. If your meditation practice is making you more neurotic, if it's making you more of an asshole and less compassionate, if it's destabilizing your life where you feel like you're not able to go to work and just do the normal stuff you got to do, then you might be doing it in a dysfunctional, neurotic, unhealthy way. In which case, the lesson there is, what would be a functional and a healthy way of doing it? See? And only you can figure that out for yourself. Of course, you can glean ideas from me and from other sources and people who have come before you, but ultimately, you got to figure that out for yourself. And you got to know when to quit sometimes. Not permanently, but just, you know, sometimes you get defeated. Sometimes you lose a few battles. That doesn't mean you lose the war. It just means you lost a few battles. Sometimes you need to make a strategic tactical retreat. Because sometimes what can happen is actually, you know, you push yourself too far, you overextend yourself, and then you kind of, you can make the path even longer for yourself. Like, you might go do a retreat. The retreat will be so brutal to your ego that after you are done with that retreat, for example, you'll have such a huge backslide that you'll stop meditating for a year. And you won't go to another retreat for another 5 years because you were just so traumatized by this. You know, you bit off more than you could chew. Or maybe psychedelics. Do you take too much psychedelics? This can definitely happen to you. And then what happens is that, see, people think that, oh, well, psychedelics, Leo, I'm just going to keep upping the dose and take a large dose. Look, I did 4 tabs, 5 tabs of LSD. I did 10 grams of mushrooms. You know, I did 30 milligrams of 5-MeO. But then what happens is that you get freaked out one of these high doses on one of these high dose trips. And then you swear off psychedelics forever. And you're like, oh, well, psychedelics are terrible and evil. No, they're not terrible and evil. You misuse them. And rather than being wise about it and going slowly, you try to do it all in one shot. And of course, you failed miserably. And then you tucked your tail between your legs and ran away. And now you're terrified to go back and try it again. Yeah, of course. This is the mark of an amateur. An amateur gets way in over his head into something to the point where he can't handle it, and then he has to back out, run away, and never face it again. This is how you fail. If you want to succeed, you got to take the slow tortoise approach. You know, the tortoise wins the race. Slow and steady in this work. If you're starting a business, this is the right approach. You don't just go and invest all of your life savings into some outlandish idea that you have for a business just to see it all fail, because it probably will fail. Your first business will probably fail. But rather, you take a slow, methodical, long-term approach where you're thinking 5, 10 years down the road and you're thinking like, I'm not just going to start one business. I'm going to become good at business in general. I have many business ideas. I'm going to try this thing. I'm going to try that thing. If this doesn't work, I'll keep trying. I'll keep trying. And then maybe by your 5th or 10th business idea, something will work. Well, same thing with relationships. Same thing with, you know, starting a family. If you get too in over your head, it's going to fail. Or any kind of project, some art project. I know I had this problem when I was doing video game design. When I was younger, you know, I trained myself to be a video game designer and developer. And the way I did that is just through projects. I would basically come up with some idea for a game, and then I would start it and try to program it and do the art and design for it and so forth. But of course, one of the problems with video game design is that it's so easy to get way over your head and bite off so much more than you could chew. You underestimate how much work is involved to implement some idea. So one of the keys to creating a video game or a movie or any kind of big project is to just know your own limits and to be very careful about the scope of your project. If the scope gets way out of hand, you have too much stuff you need to do, you're never going to be able to do it. And then you're going to get demoralized, and of course you're going to quit. So I've had plenty of projects like that. And then those projects where I succeeded, those were projects with very limited scope where I was very careful and I was clear about my own limitations. And I said, you know, I can only work so many hours a day, and this project can only take so much. You know, I have to complete this within the next 6 months or 12 months because I don't have forever. I can't spend 5 years on this. So I need a project. I need to scale down my project to make sure that I can do it in this amount of time and all that. And even then, still it's hard. Still you can fail. So the same kind of logic needs to apply to your spiritual pursuits as well to avoid the dangers of this work. Now, there's other dangers. I've only begun to really to scratch the surface of all the different dangers there are with this work. One enormous danger is turning this work into a dogma or into an ideology. I think I've talked about this plenty in the past, but it's such a big trap that people still, you know, don't get it. As much as I talk against ideology and the dangers of it, it's really, really hard to avoid turning this work into an ideology and into a religion and into a dogma, into a moral system, into a set of rules and commandments, something that you do mechanistically. This is just a natural tendency of all spiritual work. See? I present a lot of wisdom and insights and models, and I make grandiose statements about truth and reality here. And it's very easy to misconstrue that as me being an ideologue, as me sitting here and preaching my ideology of God or truth or consciousness to you. That's not what's really going on. It's very easy to confuse genuine teachings with ideology, or to turn genuine teachings into ideology. See? Because your mind wants nothing more than a set of like bullet points that it can just memorize and then execute. But that's not spirituality. That's the opposite. Everything that I teach you and anything you learn from anybody about spirituality, you have to hold very loosely. It isn't the truth. It's just talk about the truth. Talk about God isn't God. Well, it also is, but but it isn't what's being pointed at. See, don't confuse the pointers with the thing that we're pointing at. For example, I present spiral dynamics. And, you know, once you learn spiral dynamics and it becomes a good model that you know, you're like, oh, well, this is a cool model. Look, it explains what's happening on the evening news. Look, it explains what happens in religion. Look, it explains what happens in history. It explains what happens in my family. It explains what happens in business. Yeah, it does explain a lot of those things. But like I've said before, the better the model, the bigger the problem. See, it can become such a good model that you then use it exclusively. And you can't think outside of it. And you can't consider other models. And everything now is judged through the lens of spiral dynamics. And that becomes a danger. Or like you get into spirituality, another, you know, common danger is that you get into spirituality through one school, one path, one teacher, and then you think that that is the whole of spirituality, is that. Whether it's Eckhart Tolle or Buddhism or some branch of yoga, some guru that you have seen on YouTube somewhere, or someone like Jed McKenna and his sort of nihilistic approach to non-duality. You know, you get into one of these. Usually when someone learns about non-duality or spirituality, they learn about it through one source that kind of resonates with them. But then they get too attached to that source. They think that that source is somehow the pinnacle. And then they limit their spirituality to that one source. And of course, that becomes a big problem. It's very easy to misinterpret various high insights about God, about truth, about reality, about consciousness. It's very easy for the ego, you know, because it's not fully purified and dead yet. It's very easy for it to kind of like try to use awakening or non-duality to further its own agenda in a sort of a sneaky, deceptive way where, you know, and I've seen this, you know, where people talk about spirituality, but yet at the same time, they go to the club and do pickup. And then they justify their pickup through their spiritual practice, for example. Or the reason that they meditate is because it helps them to do pickup, which is, of course, a very twisted reason for meditation. You can use spirituality. You know, another trap of spirituality is that you develop a whole ideology or a whole mental scheme in your mind of how spiritual you are because you're doing all this spiritual stuff. You're going through the motions of meditation and you're going to retreats and you're listening to videos and reading books and doing this sort of stuff. But really, you're just doing it outwardly. Inwardly, none of the work that needs to be done has really been done. Really, you're avoiding the actual emotional labor of spiritual purification. See, that's the heart of this work, is the spiritual purification of your body and your mind. That is that feeling you feel. This is the emotional labor. It's the feeling you feel when you're sitting there on your meditation cushion and you're meditating, even though your ego wants to go eat some ice cream or watch some TV or jerk off to some porn. You're still sitting there and you're meditating anyways, and you're feeling like the pain, the suffering of your ego kind of shriveling and contracting as you're sitting there and kind of forcing it to be conscious and not to give in to temptation. And in that moment, that suffering you're feeling, that is literally like the devil leaving your body. That's the feeling of the devil leaving your body. The problem is that there's a lot of devil in you. And this is not something you have to do once. This is something you have to do over and over and over again for years. The devil slowly leaves your body as you do these practices, if you're doing them right. But it's easy to do these practices in such a way that the devil never even begins to leave your body. Because you just trick yourself into thinking that you're doing the practices, but really you're just sitting there daydreaming and you're calling it meditation or something like that. You're not really confronting the emotional labor of it. There's so many traps here. And you should expect that there would be all these traps, and you should expect that there should be enormous emotional labor involved with awakening and with spirituality and with God realization, because if there wasn't, everyone would be walking around God realized, and they would be acting like Christ or like the Buddha. And do you see that on news? Do you see that with celebrities? Do you see that in the business sector? Do you see that amongst your friends and family? No, they're all devils, just like you. So you should expect that there's an enormous cost or some sort of a barrier. There must be a barrier against awakening, because if there wasn't, everybody would be awake and we wouldn't be here talking about it. But less than 1% of people are awake. So the barrier must be enormous. See, and that barrier is unique for different people. And confronting that barrier, you know, you can confront that barrier in an unhealthy, dysfunctional way. Like, there are safe ways of doing psychedelics and there's dangerous ways of doing psychedelics. There are safe ways to do yoga and dangerous ways to do yoga. You have to also understand that just by the nature of this work, this is psychological work that we're doing and spiritual work, there's always going to be some portion of the population who listen to me who are going to end up hurting themselves. No matter what I say, no matter how many warnings and caveats I give. Because a lot of times people who are attracted to this work are people who are already going through depression. They are already neurotic. They already have various traumas that they're dealing with. They're looking for solutions to that. See, and whether some of my techniques work and help that person or not, who knows? You got to be careful. See, person like that could try some psychedelic and then lose their mind. It's possible, in theory. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can harm your own life in the sense that, you know, maybe right now you have a good career that you spent 10 years building up that you're happy with. Maybe you got a wife and a family and a husband or whatever that you're happy with. You got a house that you're happy with and so forth. And then you learn about awakening. And then you go on this journey, do stuff that I say. And then what ends up happening is that you find out that everything is meaningless. Maybe you take some LSD, whatever. Find out that everything is meaningless. And then you leave your wife and husband and you abandon your kids and you abandon your house and you stop going to work because you find it meaningless and all this. And then by the end of it, you find your whole life ruined. And maybe you had a large savings and you say, oh, well, money's stupid. So you just give all that savings away to some charity and then you end up with no money. And then at the end of all that, you realize, oh, wait a minute, I probably did need that money. Probably not smart to give all my money away because I do need to survive somehow. And then at the end of that, you could find yourself like having ruined your own life. So do be careful about if you're doing this work. There are going to be phases. Expect that. There's going to be highs and there's going to be lows. And usually after a high comes a low. So expect that. Be careful about making rash decisions. Be careful about making decisions like quitting your job, giving away all your money, leaving your family, you know, this sort of stuff. You know, think those through, give yourself time. Find yourself maybe one or two people who are also into this work that you could have a conversation with in worst case scenarios when you're feeling really bad. Consider hiring a life coach and working with a life coach. That can be also effective to help you to have somebody to rely on, or a therapist if you want, although many therapists are not going to understand what you're going through, and in fact they might try to discourage you, and they might say, oh, you're losing your mind, or this stuff that Leo told you isn't true and all this. Well, because of course you have to try to find people who are pretty conscious themselves already to be able to appreciate the things you're learning here and to understand the stuff you're going through. Of course, it helps to read books to give yourself a nice theoretical foundation. I can't stress that enough, especially if you're going to be tripping real deep. Really helps. It helps to create a sort of a context to tell you, like, what's normal, what's not normal, what's healthy, what's unhealthy. You can figure that out by reading some books. Check out my book list. I got like close to 50 books on spirituality and non-duality on there, which explain a lot of these nuances, a lot of traps, a lot of pathologies, a lot of ways things can go wrong, stories that people share about how their awakenings went wrong and how they fixed it or didn't fix it, so forth. Research that. And still, I feel like I'm missing other dangers that I need to tell you about, but this is what's come to mind so far. I think you get the idea now, right? So yeah, be careful. On the one hand, really doesn't matter what happens in your life. Even if you die, it's all going to be okay. That's from the absolute perspective. Now, that doesn't help you at all from the relative ego perspective. From the perspective of your own little personal ego and your own personal life and relative to your suffering that you're going to experience, you can really paint yourself into a corner in life where you do some dumb things and then hurt yourself physically, mentally, psychologically, and you just make the thing longer than it needed to be. See, sometimes when you go slower, you actually end up getting there faster than when you try to rush. It's sort of one of those counterintuitive ways in which life works. See, not always is the fastest speed the quickest way to get to where you want to get to. All right, that's it for this one. Please click like button for me and come check out actualize.org. I did recently launch on Patreon, so you can also go to patreon.com/actualized and support me on there if you find these videos useful and you want to chip in a few bucks a month to help me to upgrade equipment and to maybe do some advertising in the future, get more subscribers and other improvements that I have planned. That helps. So thank you for your support. But on my website, you will find the blog where I post content, exclusive videos and things quite frequently. You'll find the book list that I was talking about. You'll find the Life Purpose Course, which can help you to get a sense of direction in your career and in your life. Basically, it's all the principles. The Life Purpose Course, what it is, first of all, it's completely exclusive content, all new. Not anything that I've talked about in my normal videos that you've seen. So there's that. Second of all, in the Life Purpose Course, we talk about new topics, topics I haven't talked about anywhere else. And then thirdly, basically, I give you principles and the blueprint that I use to create my own career in my life. And not just actualize.org, but even before that, with various businesses that I've worked on. So I'm not just telling you how to do what I do. It's not about that. It's much broader than that. It's helping you to figure out what your ultimate dream in life is, what you want to be doing, what you're passionate about, and how to turn that passion, convert that passion into an action plan to then build a real career out of it that earns you money. So it's a very practical course. It's not abstract and airy-fairy. It tells you, it guides you step by step how I did it and how you could do it. And those principles I developed myself by just trying to figure it out for myself, because this was one of the things that occupied the first 25 years of my life, maybe even 30 years of my life, basically, is figuring out how I could build a passionate career for myself, because I knew that that's what I wanted and needed in order to be satisfied with my life. And it was a struggle. I failed many times before I figured it out. So those principles are in the course. And what am I forgetting? Yeah, the book list, the course, the Patreon. That's basically it. The last thing I want to say is that this work requires nuance. Nuance, nuance, nuance. You have to be very careful and very nuanced in how you go about it. You can't be sloppy here. You can't just take the things I say for granted. You have to think them through. Do they actually make sense? Do they correspond with your own experiences? Can you validate the things that I say? It's not about believing me. It's also about being careful not to misinterpret the things I say. Sometimes the most important thing I say is the thing that I don't say To really understand a teaching, you oftentimes have to understand what the teacher isn't saying, not just what they are saying. See? Your ideas of God or love or consciousness or awakening, chances are they're very wrong. You might think you're understanding everything I'm talking about, but you don't. So be careful assuming that you understand the things I talk about. There's many, many layers to it. Easy to misunderstand, of course, because your ego is always lurking behind the scenes, interpreting things in a way that serves it rather than the way that's actually true. See, you got to be careful with self-deception, denial, distraction, projection. These are all very common defense mechanisms and ways in which you can misinterpret teachings. And you also have to recognize that I can make mistakes too. See, I'm not immune to these various defense mechanisms. The only immunity you have is just your consciousness. How conscious are you? How vigilant are you? So you need to verify everything I talk about for yourself simply for the fact that you have no idea what I'm wrong about. Even if I'm right 90% of the time, that those other 10% of the time, which are those? You don't know. Am I wrong about God? Am I wrong about love? Am I wrong about meditation? Am I wrong about yoga? Am I wrong about past lives? Am I wrong about aliens? Am I wrong about psychedelics? Am I wrong about imagination? Am I wrong about hallucination? Am I wrong about relationships? You don't know. It's almost guaranteed, given how much I talk, that I'm wrong about some of this stuff. Or maybe I'm perfect. But how do you know? From your point of view, you don't know, so you can't just take my word for it, because I could be wrong about that. Even if I told you that I am perfect, well, what if I'm wrong? You don't know. So you got to figure all this out for yourself. Of course, you can use my work as sort of a launching point. It can be helpful in that sense. But don't get too attached to it. Hold it loosely. Don't get ideological about it. Be very nuanced about it. Because understand that reality itself is far more nuanced than anything that can be said about it. Everything we say about it is an oversimplification, an overgeneralization. It's a way of talking about it. It's a partial perspective. It's a truth from a certain point of view, as Obi-Wan Kenobi told Luke. So the things I tell you, really, you got to always remember, they're not absolute truths. They're truths from a certain point of view. And that's what you'll discover as you go through and you try to verify some of the things I talk about, is that you'll discover like, oh, well, this is what Leo was talking about all that time. Here it is, but it's not like what Leo said it was. Was he lying? Was he wrong? And then maybe you'll discover that I was wrong. Or maybe what you'll discover is like, no, he wasn't wrong. He wasn't lying per se. It's just that he was explaining it from a certain point of view, from his point of view. Yeah, how else could anyone explain anything but from their point of view, given their biases, given their preferences, given their filters and other things like that? No one is ever going to deliver the raw absolute truth to you through language in some pure unadulterated form. There's many layers of corruption. There's the corruption that comes from my own mental filters, and then there's the corruption from your mental filters. So the teacher can be corrupt and the student can be corrupt, and oftentimes both is the case. And then a lot of distortion happens in this way. So keep all that in mind. Stick around, because there's going to be a lot more content in the future about new topics that I haven't covered yet.